is the New York State AFERD podcast entitled A through Z Health and PE. We are your co-hosts, Drs. C and C, the true Pan-American connection. I am Clancy Seymour, and my tag team partner is the one and only Dr. Victor Ramsey.
Details highlighting our episodes, guests, contact information, publications, and other useful resources will always be included in the podcast show notes. For more information about New York State AFERD, please visit newyorkstateaferd.org or Facebook and social media handles at New York State AFERD. Let's embrace the journey, and now, on to our show.
Evening, everyone. Nice to see all of you. My name's Colleen. I'm the Executive Director of New York State AFERD, and I'm going to start us off this evening. So thank you for being with us as we continue New York State AFERD's Equity, Diversity, and Inclusiveness educational series. Our moderators for this evening include Dr. Sherry Treadwell. Sherry is an Associate Professor of Physical Education and Student Teaching Coordinator in the Kinesiology, Sports Studies, and Physical Education Department at SUNY Brockport. And Sherry is the current EDI Section President. Also joining us this evening is Dr. Clancy Seymour. Clancy's an Associate Professor and Director of Health, Physical Education, and Sport Pedagogy in the Department of Kinesiology at Canisius College and the current president of New York State AFERD. Also with us this evening is Dr. Victor Ramsey. Dr. Ramsey is an educational administrator and a member of the implementation team with the New York City Department of Education Office of School Wellness Programs. Victor is also an adjunct assistant professor at York College in the School of Health Sciences and Professional Programs, which is in the Department of Health and Human Performance. Dr. Ramsey is the immediate past president of our New York State AFERD Equity, Diversity, and Inclusiveness section.
Thanks, Colleen. Yes, indeed, some applause are necessary. Before we begin, we strive to create a safe and brave space for open and frank conversation on a topic that can certainly create some uneasy feelings. Please note that this session is being recorded, and remember to keep yourself muted. We also invite you to keep your camera on if you wish.
Yes, welcome everyone. Feel free to change your profile name to a pseudonym if you feel more comfortable sharing anonymous thoughts and perspective. Towards the end of our session, we will be posting links in the chat box for a certificate of attendance and a link for those of you in need of CTLE hours. If time permits, our guest speakers will answer questions and or comments. Additionally, the contact information we've made available for further discussion.
Thanks, Victor. And this evening's session is titled Creating Safe Spaces for LGBTQIA+ Students and Athletes. And we are excited to have Shauna Marie O'Toole. Shauna was 19 years an industrial technician and scientist before becoming a science teacher in rural New York State public schools. She came out as a trans woman in her eighth year of teaching. Even though O'Toole was tenured, she was forced out. This was before there were statewide or federal level protections of any kind. The Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act, GENDA, would not be passed for almost another decade. Shauna has shared her story from coast to coast. She is a certified safe space trainer by the Out Alliance and has done trainings as part of the LGBTQ Center of the Finger Lakes and We Exist Coalition of the Finger Lakes. Our second presenter is Mr. Jeremy Thode. Jeremy is the interim principal director of Health, PE, Fine and Applied Arts, Business, Tech, Facts, and Athletics at the Center Mauritius High School and at Center Mauritius High School, and is a Smithtown Central School District Board of Education trustee and co-founder of Jonah's Mission for Kids 501c3. He is the chairperson of the Chapter 11 Diversity, Equity, Inclusivity Committee and the Suffolk County Representative for Long Island Team Up for Unity Community. And so before we get started with our questions, I would like to ask both Jeremy and Shauna to give us some context for tonight's session by sharing just a bit of your stories. So if you could each share a little bit about yourself and what brings you here and how you can see yourself helping further our cause and to be more inclusive, that would be fantastic.
Shauna, go first.
Thank you. My name is Shauna Marie O'Toole, and I guess you could say I am a Jane of all trades, mistress of none, but better than any who's master of one. I've had a career in sciences and education, everything from digging holes in cemeteries, legally, got to put that in, to, it's okay, by all means, please laugh, I appreciate it. I'll be here all week, trying to be able to tell me waitresses with a combo meal, validate your parking pass. I'm like this all the time. I've dug holes in cemeteries, had a laboratory 1,000 feet underground, helped with a project that flew aboard shuttle. 11 years an earth science teacher, brought her passing rate from 32% on up to 92.5%. Transitioned as a public high school teacher and was immediately put onto a teacher improvement plan. Of course, at the time I was going through the divorce from hell, puberty 2.0, which is a real thing. Feel free to ask about that. And culture shock of being me 24/7, 365. I am a mom to a wonderful son who is now engaged. He and his fiance are heading on out to West Coast in a few months. I'm an author. I'm working on my fifth novel. I have two memoirs out. How many people could put numbers in front of memoirs? And it's been a wild life. Feel free to ask me anything. There are only just two questions I won't answer. And let me explain why. Number one is my dead name. You know, if you're an expert with Google, you can figure this out. But that was a lie I lived with for 50 years. I am Shauna, always have been. I knew who I was at age 4. I couldn't transition till I was 50. The other one is what my kids and my ex were going through. That's their story. And I think they have a right to share their story as they see fit. So it's my way of giving respect to them. So in a nutshell, it's who I am. I've shared my story coast to coast. My first memoir out is called You Can't Shave in the Mini Mart Bathroom. And trust me, you can't. The soap is not slippery enough. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jeremy.
Thank you. It's a hard one to follow. So my name is Jeremy Thode. You heard my title. I'm the youngest of 13 children. For those of you who are old enough to know, if you ever remember this, the show All in the Family, Archie Bunker was my dad, and Edith was my mom, except my mom's very intelligent. So I think that piece was not true, but they, youngest of 13 children. My mother's 92 years old. My father passed away 9 years ago. But that was the, kind of the environment I grew up in. Again, being the youngest of 13 children, we all happened to go to Catholic school, the same Catholic school. So we had certain values that were, you know, taught to us, which is fine. And in my Catholic school, we had a wide array of students and diversity, you know, some of which were Black, and some of my best friends were Black. And I used to go home and hear my father talk about the N-word and things that were inappropriate and things about gay people and so forth and so on. And thankfully, for whatever reason, I don't know why, I never kind of subscribed to it. I live and let live. I went through school with all kinds of different friends and all different types of groups. And I considered that, you know, being in a school, a high school at least, and a college that was diverse was a great experience for me. So fast forward, I have four children of my own and had the normal life that I would expect. Somebody who's a former college athlete, ultimately went into the field of education, became a phys ed teacher, followed by a athletic director. In fact, one of my former students is on this webinar. There she is. So that's nice to see. So, kind of the prototypical athlete turned phys ed teacher turned athletic director turned parent, raising a family, wanting all my kids to be athletes and following my footsteps, ultra competitive, that type of thing. And, things started off that way. And 2 years ago, well, let me go back. My second child was, had a very, very difficult childhood, trying to kind of, you know, figure things out. And what I mean that by that is, you know, would have some, social issues, would have trouble committing to, you know, whether it's a party, a sport, an activity, a club, had a lot of emotional outbursts, a lot of struggles. And as a parent of who is an educator and a wife who was a nurse at the time and is now a social worker, we've done everything we could throughout my child's life to kind of support and figure out. We went on diets, we spoke with professionals, we saw doctors, try to figure out what was going on, and really could never really figure it out. We'd see some improvement and we see five steps back. And that happened throughout elementary school, middle school, into high school. And there was a therapy session where my child went up to the therapist's office with my wife and my oldest daughter, who's in college. Went in to speak to the therapist, a few minutes later, my wife and daughter were sent in. And at that time, my child said to them that I'm transgender, 15 years old. And, there was a lot of tears. There was some hugging. There was some conversation. And they left the therapist's office not too long after that, went downstairs into the parking lot. My child jumped up in the air, literally, and said, I'm free. They drove home. I had happened to get home from work before they got home. I was in my bedroom laying down watching some TV, and my wife, old oldest daughter, came in the room and said to me, we got to talk to you. And I could tell by the, we got to talk to you, that something was up. And they brought me into my daughter's room, sat me down, and proceeded to tell me what happened with the therapist and that my child was transgender. And I can't deny it. Immediately, I burst into tears. I mean, big tears. And I'm going to tell you very, very clearly, there was two reasons that I burst into tears. One was because my child for 15 years didn't live the life that was him. And two was I knew the challenges that he would be facing moving forward, possibly for the rest of his life. And I know that because I actually had the first transgender athlete as an athletic director in New York State high school. Interscholastic, middle school at the time. So I was the first athletic director in New York State that had a student, and I worked with that family and I learned a lot from that family and that child. So I knew what the deal was. Coincidentally, my wife had just finished her degree as a social worker, and that was through her first year after raising four kids for, 12 years at the time, or something like that, 10 or 12 years. Her first social work job was for Family Service League, and one of her tasks was to run a transgender group. So it was interesting that both of us had these experiences before our child came out. So I collected myself. They had told me, believe it or not, it was a Saturday when this happened. They told me that my son wanted to tell me directly, personally, himself, but he wanted to do it the next day, Sunday. So now here I am, just getting over being in tears, and have to go back in my room and have to hold this in, and for a day, and spend the whole next day, around my son and kind of trying to keep it all in. A few minutes later, they come back into the room and they said, he knows that, and he's in the kitchen and he's crying. So he wanted to talk to me. So I immediately went out into the kitchen. He's there. He leaves the island. He runs over to me. He grabs me. He hugs me. And he whispers in my ear, "Do you hate me?" And the response I gave him was that I could never hate you. And I still get choked up about that. We proceeded to talk. And that night, I went up into his double bed and laid in his bed with him. We talked, we laughed, we cried. I asked questions. He had all the answers. Interesting enough also is, again, he was in the middle of, towards the middle of ninth grade. And he figured out who he was. Specifically, when he was in sixth grade, when he started puberty, and he realized, and for 18 months, he realized who he was. He didn't tell a soul. He researched, he found information. He found medical stuff. He knew everything. I mean, we were stunned. That just blew me away because my son and I were really close all through his life. In fact, to this day, he's always, when he comes down in the morning or he sees me after I come home from work, he'll run down the stairs and hug me to this day. And we've had a lot of good times and a lot of good talks, but he, for 18 months, didn't feel comfortable sharing with anybody. In fact, he only shared it with one person online that he met through a gaming app or something. And that person was from Tennessee, and that was who he shared with. So it was a safe situation. So real quickly, we've spent the next several months talking to our family and our close friends. And again, interesting enough, my son required that he was there and he was part of every conversation we had. And we educated ourselves even more. We got into advocacy. We got into groups that would help support us. We did everything under the sun that we could do. Now, I have a very, very public life as a professional, very involved, always have been very involved as a leader. And I decided with my son's support to let everyone know our story because I thought it was very important to be proud and to be advocating and to be open, not feel like I have to hide or he has to hide. And quite frankly, across the board, because we were very, very open and very honest and very real. We had very little issues. And part of that is because I'm privileged as a white educated male. There's no doubt about it. I believe that for very truly, that here's somebody who was, you know, very, very involved in community and in leadership and whatever else. And it impacts people a little differently, in my opinion. So that was a good thing for us. It's not a good thing. It shouldn't have to be that way, but I believe it to be true. We started a nonprofit originally to support transgender youth. And then we realized my youngest daughter has ADHD and my other children were kind of being swept aside as we dealt with Noah's transition. So we realized how important it was to really advocate for all children, anybody who feels biased against, uncomfortable in their own skin, dealing with issues and so forth. So the work we're doing is very, very at the start, very in the beginning, but we are planning to do a lot of work with schools and families and individuals who need assistance. We've done quite a few, Noah and I have done quite a few presentations in New York State, to New York School Board Association, Superintendents Associations, Principal Associations, Athletic Director Associations, BOCES, telling our story and giving people support and advocacy and anything they need. And Noah's also worked with individual kids that, because our message has gotten out, and kids that have felt more comfortable coming out. So he works with them one-on-one, very informally. So it's been an interesting ride. There's a lot of work to do. And, I'm glad to be here.
Wow. Jeremy and Shauna, that was truly powerful and moving. Thank you very much. Thank you.
My pleasure.
We now would like to ask you a few questions for this evening. Our first question to Jeremy and Shauna both, in no particular order, is to just maybe comment or describe how physical education and or athletics has or continues to exacerbate social issues with LGBTQIA plus populations, either presently or historically.
Shauna, you want to start?
I can do that. I was looking it up the other day online, former student of mine who has a trans child who is going through puberty and right now I believe is in denial, but we'll see what happens in the future. The child was shamed into the closet by his biological father after coming out. There are 33 states with anti-LGBTQ legislation aimed primarily at youth, especially trans kids. They're being used as a political tool by a particular political party. And I'm double checking here. I have my notes here in front of me and I'm keeping the questions in front of me as well. So I'm going back and forth, forgive me. You know, if you look, you know, a girl playing a traditional male sport is thought by some people to be making a statement that girls are just as good as boys. A boy playing a female sport by the same people is considered to be a physical threat in general. A student who is gay or gender nonconforming in presentation is at risk of being assaulted. I had a student who is gay, but expression at the time was very gender nonconforming. In fact, the first time I met the student, I thought the student was female. And he was absolutely terrified of going to phys ed because he was terrified of being assaulted. It was something no one had thought of. So fortunately, I had him just before his phys ed class. I called the office, said, the student is with me. He is not skipping. And right then and there, I went through the stuff to go ahead and get this child protected so he had a safe place to change. And things like that by us as educators set a standard and a role model. Other kids know who's safe. Other educators know, okay, this is how I'm supposed to act. But right now we're political tools and no child should be a political tool. And you're going to find I'm very political in my answers. I just completed a run for state Senate, failed, but no, I'll say I didn't win because I still pulled in 36% of the vote in a very Republican area. Jeremy, please take it, or I'm just going to keep talking.
No, that's fine. Thank you. So I think there's a few pieces to this that I can add to. One of the jobs or one of the things that I worked with was I got in touch with our GSAs in Suffolk County, New York. I thought it was important. Again, when my son transitioned, we also found out that my daughter identifies as bisexual. So thought it was very important to be inclusive in the work that I was doing and not just be focusing on transgender children. Because there's more power with a group of people. And so I got in touch with the GSAs and we ended up creating a GSA forum conference, I should say. And what that was about 10 or 11 schools. We met at a school that offered their library. And we brought them in and we scheduled the day. We had guest speakers, myself, my son, some other people. We had some activities, we had food and all that type of stuff. And in that work, what we did is we had all these kids intermingle at different tables. And then they would talk about different topics related to LGBTQ life as a student in schools. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we got a whole bunch of data from these kids, from what they experience in their individual schools, who many of those schools are very supportive of LGBTQ plus students. And one of the things when I extrapolated that data was one of the things that was a very, very big indicator was locker rooms, bathrooms and locker rooms, especially in gym or athletics. And that fear that Chana was talking about and teasing and bullying and all that type of stuff. So that number one is the issue. It's real. Part of that problem, in my opinion, is the cultures of school districts, the community itself, what their values are, what their culture is. And that's an obstacle that is real, and it changes depending on different communities. Some are a little bit better, some are not. Some kids feel a little bit more comfortable coming out because of their community culture or their school culture. Unfortunately, there is still leadership, whether it be superintendents or board of educations or administrators or even teachers or coaches, who have an old school mentality, whether it's their personal beliefs, or their family beliefs that they bring into the school, or whether it's the beliefs of the culture of the community. So, the fact is that it's real that kids feel uncomfortable. I'll give you the quick story. Again, the student that I worked with that was an athlete in my school district, the first transgender student, I had a conversation with the mom when we transitioned this child into the middle school. And I learned a lot. And initially, the child wanted a change in the bathroom of the nurse's office. And it was the smartest thing to do at that time in that community and everything. And little by little, mom was contacting me and saying, she really wants to use the locker room. And I was talking her out of it. Again, at the time, I wasn't as educated as I am now. And I kept saying, listen, everything's going great. Like, why mess with it? We don't want people coming, storming the Board of Education meetings, saying that, your child's going to be, seeing their child, their daughters changing in the locker room and all that type of stuff. And this conversation went back and forth for a couple of weeks. And finally, the mom said to me, listen, Mr. Thode, you keep talking about, the other children and their families being scared that my child's going to see them change in the locker room. Said, Mr. Thode, every morning my child wakes up and takes a shower and looks in the mirror and is heartbroken with what she was born with. And every morning she bounds herself up so that her body parts aren't seen. And you keep saying to me, Mr. Thode, what if she sees other people changing? My child is deathly afraid of somebody else seeing her change. And that for me was an aha moment. It was an aha moment because I did not have that perspective. I did not understand what it's like to be in somebody else's skin. So ultimately, when we talk about phys ed locker rooms or coaching practices or, the athletic and phys ed realm, ultimately, it's about understanding different perspectives. Ultimately, it's about having difficult conversations. And ultimately, it's about changing mindset. So all of those things are important. And I think we're going to get in a little bit deeper into some of those answers a little bit later in this question and answer. So,
all right. Thank you both, Jeremy and Chana, for well thought out and the answers. This is again for both of you. How do we move the profession forward and get more teachers and administrators to become more inclusive in their thoughts and actions?
Why don't you start off, Jeremy?
Okay. So this is not there's no easy answer to this, and there's no, magic wand. The bottom line is what we have to do is find champions. Okay. We're not going to be able to change everybody's mind. We're not going to be able to change their, their background unless they want to be what they've learned, their biases, I should say, unless they want to. So finding champions who will be a good examples, finding champions and when I say champions, I don't care who it is. It could be the teacher. It could be the coach. It could be an administrator. It could be a parent. It could be a leader as a kid. Finding people who will go above and beyond. This is not a secret in education. I teach a DASA class for New York State. And I do this example. I'm going to do it with you since you're all here, at least the ones that I see on video. And I want you to raise your hand if you can remember the names, two or three names of educators in your life kindergarten through college, who were champions, who went above and beyond, did everything possible to help kids. You know, you remember their names, like who they are. You could say, "Mom, Mr. Smith," right? Everybody could do that. Now, I want you to do the same thing. I want you to tell me, raise your hand if you can remember the names of two or three educators who had bad reputations, who did cut corners, who did nasty things to kids, who were, you know, that type of thing. Right, you get the message, right? So we remember the really great ones. We remember the really bad ones. And then the third question would be, raise your hand if you can remember the names of everybody else. Now, you might be able to pick a few, you know, maybe a third grade teacher, this guy teacher, whatever else. And when I teach this DASA class, I use that as an example. And I said, well, what kind of educator do you want to be? Do you want to be somebody who is remembered and revered? Do you want to be remembered as somebody who was a joke and hurt people and hurt kids? Or do you want to be forgotten? So that's ultimately, as educators, what we should be focusing on. And I tell them right there and then, if you're not here for the right reason as a DASA class, in the DASA class, in order to get your certification in whatever area you're going to get, if you're not here for the reason, don't go into education. That's having a difficult conversation. Get out, leave. We have too many of those people that don't care, or, you know, that are forgotten. You know, those things are important, finding the champions and then having that difficult conversation. And when I say the difficult conversation, it does not have to be adversarial. That is one of the huge things that I've learned as an educator, and I got to be honest, learned through my own kids and their journeys, is, you know, we're in an environment right now, we're in a, you know, in a political arena right now where it's one or the other. You know, there's no in between. You know, if you support police officers, then you're a certain way. If you support Black, you know, Lives Matters or any other area, you're considered a certain way. Okay. There are good people everywhere. There's good people. I remember teaching my DASA class, and I had an old timer that was in the class. I mean, really, you know, old school. And he said, we were talking about all this type of stuff, and I'm not going to use the word he used, but he basically said, there are two types of people, good people and bad people. Now, he used the bad word. I'm not going to share that now. And that's really what we got to think about, is there are good people. And unfortunately, 5% of the people make 95% of the noise. And I believe 95% of the people either, you know, stand up and do the right thing and are upstanders, or maybe just kind of go about their business. So ultimately, we got to find the champions. Ultimately, we have to have the difficult conversation. And sometimes we have to be very careful, have that conversation. Sometimes we have to move things along slowly. Sometimes we can be a little bit more aggressive. And that's a skill you have to learn based on the culture and the community you're in, or in the environment you're in. And I think you can get more bees with honey. Shauna?
You hit a lot of what I was going to say, Jeremy. I think what I'll add to it is, with the difficult conversations, you have to have a presence. You need to have LGBTQ people coming in to meet with the faculty, the staff, the administrators, and give them a chance. Ask your questions. You know, let us share our stories. Ask your questions. Here's your chance. Ask anything you want, and except, at least for me, for those two things I told you about before, I'll answer it. And most people, when they meet someone LGBTQ, unless they've had that experience before, they have a blank sheet of paper. And they fill it up with making stuff up. And everyone has a PhD in MSU, making stuff up. The best way how to do that is to get around that is to get in and be a presence, let people ask questions. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Human Library. Up here in the Rochester area, there've been a couple of libraries that brought in people with particular stories, and we would be checked out for 30 minutes. And we will share our stories and answer questions. Maybe something like that is necessary here for educators, where you bring in people who are broad spectrum, not just LGBTQ, but let's bring in students who are autistic, who have physical or emotional issues that they got to deal with. Let educators ask. Now we're bringing adults, let educators ask. And that's this way you take the fear away. We're no longer unknown. And I think the more we get rid of the unknown, the faster people will become educated, say, you know, you have a good point there.
Awesome.
Can I just add also, and I just want to make sure I'm clear on this, is that the only thing when we talk about difficult conversation or being, being an advocate or anything, the only thing that's non-negotiable is violence or harm. I don't want to come across as, you know, just kind of stand in the middle. When it comes to violence or harm or anything like that, that's non-negotiable. So I just wanted to point that out.
Agreed.
Thank you, Jeremy, Shauna, for such, I am just in awe because I consider myself someone growing and learning. And I believe that education is a quest from birth until. So what you're doing for us is certainly much appreciated. And, you know, you alluded a little bit about it somewhat, Jeremy and Shauna, about educating others and some of those strategies. New York State AFIRD and members and us here do not have the luxury right now of having a Shauna and Jeremy accessible to answer, to help us to educate others. So how do you think we should go about educating teachers and administrators to acquire more information in order to support LGBTQIA+ community in physical education and athletics? I know we talk about certain resources, and you did allude to the fact about how to engage in that conversation, bringing in guest speakers, so on and so forth. But anything you can add to kind of make it a more robust approach to educating the audiences, the teachers, the people that we are in daily contact with, i.e. teachers and administrators? Anything you can add to that, please?
Sure. I would tell you, because I think this is the most powerful, is our own kids. Our own kids are the most powerful, and you might have to train them. You might have to, you know, certain kids are great. I mean, they just have it. You know, they can speak publicly. They can express themselves appropriately. Some you might have to prepare because you don't want anything to come off, you know, in a negative way, or them embarrass themselves because they don't, whatever. Because I've seen that happen, not just, you know, in this particular realm, or not at all in this realm, but just in other realms, I should say. So you know, again, number one, what part of my organization that we created, our nonprofit, is that I am willing to have these conversations with any school district right now, especially in New York, and especially that we have Zooms. It's not a charge. I'm not charging money for anything I do or anything like that. In fact, any of the money I get as far as donations, whatever, goes back to kids only. There's no salaries. There's no nothing like that. So I'm not pumping my nonprofit. I'm available to talk to anybody. And just to go back to the conversations I've had in my local area, you know, I've had, you know, principals say, can you come talk to my faculty? And I said, absolutely. Now, this is prior to COVID starting. So I actually had like 6 faculty meetings all set up, or superintendent's conferences, and then they were all shut down. But one of the conversations I have with the principal would be, okay, do you want the nice version or do you want the difficult conversation? You know, so again, feeling out the culture. And by and large, the principal goes, oh no, I want the difficult one. I want to make people feel uncomfortable. And again, there's a skill to doing that. But again, you may not have the resources, you may not have somebody available to come speak to staff, but we all have kids. You know, we have GSAs, we have kids that are represented, you know, in this community, in our schools. And another piece to that I learned again from the GSA conference that we put on was, you know, trying to teach these kids and trying to get these kids to, because one of the issues with GSAs is membership. You know, kids in the community may or may not want to join, and then people who are allies may not want to join because they get labeled, you know. So what I've instructed a lot of the GSAs to do is to try to join with other clubs, you know, whether it be on fundraising or activities or whatever else, to integrate, you know, the GSA members with other clubs that may be, you know, more mainstream or whatever else. But ultimately, you know, the short answer is kids. If you find kids that can speak to adults, tell their story, obviously you have to get parent permission and all that type of stuff. But that's, I found that, you know, with my own son, Noah coming and speaking to superintendents and at conferences and things like that, he steals the show. And we've also brought the second New York State School Board Association presentation we did, because we did the first one, just he and I, and it was a huge success. And they made us a featured speaker for this year's. What we did is we brought a panel of kids from the community, and they shared their experiences, and it went really well. And that's, I think, is the best way.
Jeremy, I think you hit the nail on the head here in terms of using our student resources. One thing to keep in mind here in some areas, especially up here in rural New York, I had, after I was outed on the news, what a great way to come out. I had students come up to me and tell me that they were lesbian, that they were gay, that they were bi, and asked if they could have lunch with me in my classroom, which I allowed. But they didn't dare come out to their parents because they would have been beaten within an inch of their life and thrown out on the street with nothing but the clothes on their back. So when you reach out to a GSA, there are people there in the GSA who may be out in the GSA, but they may not be out to their fellow classmates. They may not be out to their parents. So just please, please, please use caution. Other resources you can reach out to. Jeremy, if you ever need, if there's anything I can do, please reach out. Let's talk. Mm-hmm. Anyone wants to reach out, please. I'll be happy to share my story. But take a look at your local LGBTQ organization. They may already have resources that you can use to bring into your classroom. They bring into the faculty administrators, to the athletic department, to help people along. So there are lots of resources around. Just got to be a little judicious. And sometimes, and thanks to Zoom, there are resources out there that you may not realize until now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Very informative. So with that being said, Shauna and Jeremy, how do we move beyond the strict binary gender norms that physical education and athletics are centered around?
Well, again, education is key, and I've learned to kind of explain it this way in some of the conversations I've had, because people don't necessarily understand when we talk about, you know, binary or even, you know, anything related, sexual orientation, how could you be this, how could you be that, whatever else. There's clearly, you know, ignorance. The one thing I am seeing in schools, there is definitely more acceptance from kids as a general rule. That doesn't mean that there's not the bullies or the, you know, the closed-minded or the nasty kids that make bad choices. But there is a bigger openness to differences, which is wonderful. So that's a good thing. But I like to explain it like this. I happen to be a very, very patient person. My wife, not so much. There's a continuum of every emotion that we have. Some people get angry real quick. You know, some people love hard. You know, some people are very open. Some people are very personal. Every emotion and many of our identities are somewhere on a continuum. And that's no different for sexual orientation or who you feel you are in any given, you know, situation. Joking around with my wife, you know, she happens to adore Pink, the singer. If I ever was with a woman, it would be Pink, you know? And, that's not a bad thing, that we feel certain ways, we have attraction to different people, whether it be sexual or not. You know, you could be emotionally attracted to somebody of the same gender and not be, you know, attracted to them physically. So again, education, conversation, making kids in schools especially aware of, different ranges of emotions, I think is an easy way to explain it to them without them even knowing that you're explaining it to them. I think definitely some specific conversation as an athletic director who has phys ed teachers and health teachers. And again, health teachers are generally a little bit more understanding of this. And coaches is the opportunities when you have coaches meeting or staff meetings to talk about this stuff. We talk about, equipment, we talk about, strategies, we talk about whatever. So when we have these meetings in our schools, and I'm speaking specifically about, health, phys ed, and athletics, there are opportunities to break open conversations and start to seep some of this in so that they understand, because ultimately, our goal, the things we keep repeating is it's accepting and celebrate everybody. And I think when we tie that into other identities, because I think this is one of the biggest mistakes that I see is we have advocacy for people of color. We have advocacy for LGBTQ+. We have advocacy for, special ed students. We have advocacy, whatever else. But yet we have not learned yet that we should all get together and advocate together. And the minority groups will become the majority. So I really feel that that's a huge opportunity to put that all in one group of people. And that's why, again, we went with the idea for our nonprofit of anybody who feels biased against or discriminated against or different, we're going to accept and celebrate everybody. I hope that answers the question.
I agree with that 100%. I mean, how many people here have ever heard of a teenage girl being the star kicker on a football team? Anyone besides me? It happens. How about a mid-teenage boy on the field hockey team, because that's what they're able to play? When we start celebrating, instead of the girls' team, but the team, we start to bring in people there. We're already doing this here, which is what Jeremy was saying. Let's simply be open about it. Instead of talking about just LGBTQI or any other group, they're students. Let's bring them all in this way, very much like Jeremy was saying.
Thank you.
You're on mute, Sherry.
I never do that ever, I swear. where am I? So how can physical education and athletic departments work to become more inclusive of LGBTQI students and athletes? What can we do to be more inclusive of them?
Tony, you want to start? You're on mute too now. Oh, there we go.
I was flipping pages right here. Education. Bring up LGBTQ students who have succeeded in sports. Simply mention, oh yeah, this particular person, just won the gold medal. This trans person happened to do this. Education, example, role model. And then for people who are not necessarily in athletics, the faculty and staff there, being openly supportive of a student who is out. When I told you earlier here of a student who was having issues with changing to the locker room because they felt threatened, I guarantee you that spread. And students knew I was safe. And that set an expectation for everyone going, this is what we're going to be held to. And we're going to keep each other to that bar so we can keep everyone safe, provide that education, be that role model for other educators as well. Jeremy?
Yeah, so obviously we've spoken about a lot of other things during the previous questions that kind of hit upon this particular question, but I want to add one more thing that that I see that works. What we should do as phys ed teachers and coaches is find commonality with kids. So, you know, it's not a specific LGBTQ plus strategy. It's if I have a team or if I have a class, you know, whether it's icebreakers or activities or conversations about what makes us similar, and we can connect kids on emotional levels or interest levels, you know, or activity levels, those types of things, they won't make judgments about who they are as identity. It's kind of bothersome to me because, and I don't want to insult anybody here, and I don't say this incorrectly, you know, but when we talk about it, when we talk about this, sometimes it almost has a negative connotation to the students in the community, like it's taboo or it's bad. And what the reality is that we're all the same. Obviously, we all know that here, but we're all the same in a lot of regards. And this is what, again, I do in some of the work that I do is, you know, a lot of these kids, all kids, come from families that have alcoholism or drug addiction or, you know, financial issues or any number of challenges that we've all had in our lives. You know, we've all been down dark roads. Everybody here has had struggles. I have mental illness in my family. I have drug addiction in my family. I have alcoholism in my family. And I'm not suggesting that coaches and teachers talk to kids about these things because that's more of a therapy type activity. But my point is we're all connected by our struggles. And if kids get to know each other on a personal level and understand and possibly share out things that that make us, you know, make us understand each other, those labels that are given will disappear. You know, and ultimately that's what we want in any school, in any department, in any area of school, sports and athletics and phys ed included. We break down the labels and we connect kids on an emotional level and a personal level. It won't matter so much that you live in this part of town or that you have this sexual orientation or you have or you're this gender, you know, those types of things are critical. So any teacher and coach can do these things. And we talk about this. I'll share a really quick story that I think applies very well. I hired a basketball coach who was a college, big time college athlete and coached in college and had got burnt out and loved the sport, didn't want to coach in college more, and she wanted to coach girls basketball. So I interviewed her. Unbelievable. She happened to be a woman of color. And we just connected. It was just a great relationship. And I loved her. She was going to be great for my program. So she started practice first day, and my office was right by the gym. And I would go out and I'd see the girls in the center circle of the basketball court in a circle. And she was in the middle and they were talking, you know, and I'm like, okay, first day practice, 10 minutes talking, whatever. I leave the gym. I come back 10 minutes, 15 minutes later, still talking. Well, you know, first day, coach is introducing himself, whatever. I go back in my office and this happened day after day. And sometimes it was 25 minutes. Sometimes it was 40 minutes. Sometimes it was 10 minutes. Every day they would be in this circle. And I got frustrated because I'm sitting there as an athletic director. I'm like, when are we going to practice? Like, let's get to practice, you know? So I would walk by and I'd try to hear what was going on and like snoop a little bit and whatever else. And I couldn't figure it out. So one day I grabbed her and I said, Kelly, I said, what the hell are you doing? She goes, Jeremy, listen, these are 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 year old girls. Okay. They got a lot going on in their lives. They come from all kinds of backgrounds. They have all kinds of issues. Some of them are breaking up with their boyfriend. They had a big exam. They had this, they had that. So every day before practice, we share out and each kid gets an opportunity to talk and talk about what's in their life and what's stressing them or whatever else. And we don't stop until we're done for the day. Because Jeremy, I can put them out on the court for 2.5 hours, and if they're all distracted, I'm not going to get anything out of them. But if I get everything out of them that's bothering them, and I only have a 45-minute practice, and that practice is focused, I got more out of my kids as athletes. And boy, I was stunned by that. I was like, wow, that is powerful. Now, and I'm sure she learned that from her coach or whatever else, but that was just, to me at the time, like I just, you know, you don't see coaches necessarily always investing that way. And that taught me another lesson. And I continue to learn from people around me, and I will continue to keep my ears and eyes open and never judge what I think might be happening or should happening until I ask the questions and I have those conversations.
That is awesome, Jeremy. I mean, you know, you're so humbly saying you're learning, you know, and that's what educating and learning is all about. So thank you for sharing that story. I think it's a story well worth sharing. So as we wind down, I just want to get to our last question for the day. And I think that we have some faculty members here, the higher ed faculty, and I am, for one, involved in retention and recruitment. And some of the focus has been with BIPOC students, but certainly you could be a BIPOC student and still fall in this community, LGBTQ plus IA. Let me say this right. LGBTQIA plus. All right. I'm going to be, because I don't want Shauna to get at me.
Oh, but, no. It's something where we keep expanding.
Yes, everything. That's okay.
If you go with LGBT plus, that does the same thing.
That's okay.
It's all good.
Thank you. So that's okay. So how do we work to create safe spaces for gender nonconforming college students who want to become PE and or health teachers when there's an expectation on locker room supervision at the secondary level? Someone spoke about that earlier, but could you elaborate more on that? If you want me to repeat, I'd be happy to do so, because I know it was a sort of like a full mouth there. How do we work to create safe spaces for gender nonconforming college students who want to become health and PE teachers when there's an expectation of locker room supervision at the secondary level?
Hasn't this already been worked out by the colleges? I mean, look at the college and professional sports teams that have a female coach for male students, male coach for female students. What are they doing? And I will be upfront and say, this one is out of my area of expertise. Mm-hmm. I would say, look at what's being done. I'm going to throw this here directly to you, Jeremy.
Well,
that seems logical.
So, you know, there's always professional ways to do anything. Right? You know, as far as supervising a locker room, it doesn't matter to me. Here's the issue, because I've dealt with this as a professional, as an athletic director, where, you know, there have been accusations or concerns about, you know, a teacher staying in the locker room too long and watching the kids. Now, meanwhile, anybody who's either been in a locker room or had supervised a locker room, that, you know, whether it's middle school kids or high school kids, if they're in the locker room too long, bad things can happen. So we have to supervise locker rooms. And sometimes if a teacher or coach, no matter what their sexual orientation or their gender is, you know, if they're in there too long, people get, that's weird, you know, that type of thing. So I actually tell my teachers and coaches, to be very careful about supervising the locker room, because I don't want rumors or accusations or, you know, insinuations about professionals. I think there's always a professional way to supervise a locker room. You're not going to, you know, obviously if there's safety involved, if you hear noise and fighting and whatever else, and it goes for, if I'm a female coach who coaches a boys team and there's, you know, mayhem in a locker room, you got to run in and stop the fight or stop the issue. That's just safety. And as far as I've ever known and whatever, any legal thing with that would be supported if somebody was unsafe. But any other situation where we're supervising a locker room, it's basically to usher kids in and out not stay there and get yourself in any type of accusations. You know, being a presence, setting rules and expectations for being in the locker room, you know, simple things like, you know, you have 2 minutes. If you're 2 minutes, you're going to be late. And if you're late, you're going to be marked, you know, you're going to lose a point or you're going to lose whatever else. So it's really the strength of the leader as a teacher and as a coach. And then if there is a situation where, and this is on the athletic director, if there is a situation where supervision of a locker room needs to happen, and let's say it's a female teacher with a male student class, then you need to arrange for somebody of the same gender that can usher the kids out of the locker room. So there are a lot of strategies. What I would always do as a teacher, as a professional, is that's what your athletic director is or your principal is for, to ask those questions as far as how do I maintain the locker room as a male or female, depending on who you're supervising or what you need to do, what the strategies are and things like that. You know, because ultimately they're the boss. And I wouldn't want any professional who's just starting in the profession to make any choices, whether it's locker room related or supervision related or activity related, to not know what the expectations are and to get that information from your boss. I always tell my teachers and coaches, or actually I should tell you, when I do my DASA class, I get a little bit off task, and I tell them to make sure you get things in writing from your supervisors about, you know, if something is an issue, you know, I had a issue with the locker room, how do you want me to handle that? And let that person respond to them in writing so that you have yourself covered as a professional. Because unfortunately in this world, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little bit of a sun glare on my chin. So in this world, and I've seen this happen where conversations were had and then something went down negatively, and then there was deniability about, well, I didn't tell this person, I didn't, that, you know, I never told that teacher or coach to do that. So put things in writing, know the rules. Any athletic director or supervisor who is worth their, you know, worth anything, you know, has a plan book or a playbook or a code of conduct or a coaching manual, whatever they want to call it, that should address those types of things. And as a professional, if it's not addressed in any documentation or any conversation, then you need to ask the question. And again, my suggestion would be to ask it in writing.
Well stated. Thank you. You also used some powerful words earlier that I took notes of. I was writing down here. Commonalities, patience, celebration. I love those. Thank you. Thank you. Fancy?
Yes, indeed, Vix, for sure. Some of the other points that resonated with me, taking the higher road, being a professional. And if you don't know the answers, to ask the questions so that you can take the higher road and be professional, for sure. Great stuff. We have made it through our questions for our panelists. Sean and Jeremy, you've passed the test, and we are now in the speed round. And the speed round is our bonus round for all of our guests today. And so now at this point, we have a little bit of time. We're at 6:08, and this session is extended to 6:30. So we have some time if inclined to allow some of our guests today to maybe ask Shauna and Jeremy some questions. So I'll leave that to Victor, Sherry, and myself to try to moderate, maybe either raise your hand using the raise your hand feature or just signal in the camera, and we'll do our best to make sure that your voice is heard and your question asked. Casey, please go for it. And we'll go with Brandon next.
So I've kind of got two questions. So my one question, and I guess this is more of a code of conduct question, especially from like the athletic director's perspective, is there anything you've noticed like in the wording of your code of conduct or anything that as an ally, I can bring to my district and say, hey, let's look at the wording in our athletic department, in our programs, what can we change? Maybe what are their words that we're supposed to be looking for, or policies that we should be looking for? Because like you said, a couple of times, like, we should have this in writing. And so I've been kind of out of the sports game for a while. I teach health. And so I'm curious, did you notice as an athletic director, any specific terminology or your code of conduct that you've worked on, or that we can go back to our districts and ask?
Well, so number one, I just want to point out, as much as I sound like I'm an expert, I'm not an expert. Okay. If you were to ask between who's the expert, it would be my son on terminology and verbiage and all that type of stuff. So I'm sure when I speak, I say some words that may offend. That's why I'm always apologetic, and I'm always saying that I'm willing to learn, and I try to take what people have, you know, feedback people have given me and make sure I incorporate it next time I speak. As far as terminology, I would tell you that just a guess, 99.9%, and myself included, of code of conducts are antiquated. I can tell you for a fact, you know, some of the good work I've put in for my code of conduct has been shared across Long Island, at least, because I happen to be very detail oriented when I talk about my athletic handbook or my coach's handbook and things like that. So I share it out with a lot of people, and they pretty much adopt it and alter it just for their schools. But as far as for this topic for the community, I haven't gotten that expertise yet to kind of break that down. I do have resources, there actually is, I don't know off the top of my head, but I will certainly get it to anybody who asks. There is, if you Google New York State guidelines, I don't know if this one is specific to transgender students, but if you Google New York State guidelines for transgender students, at least, there's a huge packet that basically tells schools how to, how to welcome and accept transgender children into their schools. And it probably has a lot of terminology in there that could apply to an athletic thing, athletic code or handbook. I've shared it out. I don't have it in front of me. So I've shared it out with schools because, again, my name's gotten out, and I've literally have gotten, in the last week, I got two calls. One was a fourth grade student, and a school district didn't know happen to be a transgender student and didn't know how to, you know, support that child. So I, basically forwarded some resources. And then said, I'm available personally if you have more intimate questions, you know, about family and whatever else. There are resources out there. It's something that is actually on my list to do, to try to handle. But again, I'm not the super expert. And as Shauna said before, most, at least down here, there are a lot of LGBTQ+ organizations, LGBT Network, the Transgender Resource of Long Island, and many others who have a little bit more expertise, have a lot more expertise, and they can provide that information. But so there should be some in all of your areas. It may not be as much if you're upstate New York and it's, you know, spread out a little bit more. I'm not very aware of upstate New York, but there are definitely organizations that could help as well.
Other places to look online would be GLAAD, GLAAD, mm-hmm. as well as Gleason, mm-hmm. which is Gay Lesbian Student Education Network, in terms of vocabulary, resources to reach out to, both of which could be very useful to you. GLAAD is the Gay Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, so it's GLAAD. So always check there too. And it's always fair to ask, you know, can I reach out and would you take a look at this? They may say no, but unless you ask, the answer is always no.
Thank you.
Casey, did you have a second question? Or did you forget it?
Oh, I was going to say, so Shauna talked about puberty 2.0, and I've been like dying to hear about it. So.
Okay, puberty 2.0 is a real thing when you start hormone replacement. I was 50 years old. Actually, no, I was 49 when I first started HRT, but didn't transition until I was 50. Your brain regresses back to 13. And it's learning how to deal with all these new emotions that come along with the new hormones that are going through the body. And the parts of the brain affected by testosterone, the parts of the brain affected by estrogen from personal experience are totally different. And so I had to relearn how to control my emotions. And it was an absolute unmitigated hell. Because, you know, as a teenager, when you're 13, you get away with almost anything. Oh, puberty, you know, just doing stupid stuff. But you can't do that when you're 50. And it was very, very difficult. And had a lot of personal relationships get damaged as a result of that. I apologize afterwards and explained this is what was going on. I was relearning how to feel. And personally, anyone here a Star Trek fan? Besides me? Okay. The reason I bring that up, I'm old enough to remember Star Trek, the original series first run. You probably have heard of Spock. Half Vulcan, half human. Always kept his emotions in check. And you know, I knew who I was at age 4, but couldn't express it. So I found the best way for me to control myself, to keep from exploding out that I'm a girl, was to deny the existence of emotions. So not only did I have to understand what these hormones were doing to my brain, I had to relearn how to feel again. And that was tough. My first summer on HRT, a leaf would fall, I'd burst into tears. It was horrible. And I mean that literally. So if someone is starting HRT, be it a colleague or someone who is a student who may be starting HRT, be a little understanding, come in with a box of chocolates and say, hey, let's talk. And I've heard this from other people in the trans community, male to female or female to male. So it goes both ways. Hormone puberty 2.0 is real.
Thank you, Shauna. Thank you, Jeremy. Great questions, Casey. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Jeremy, you know, we were talking, Jeremy and Shauna and us a little bit beforehand about taking the edge off and indicating, you know, your vulnerability and the fact that you're not an expert, although I would contend you probably have stayed at a Holiday Inn Express or two, but nevertheless, you're modest. And so we appreciate that. I think that helps.
True. I concur. Well,
and you know what, you said a great word, being vulnerable. And I've actually used that word too, because being real and being able to talk about, again, my experience and my son talking about his experience and my wife talking about her experiences, which are very, very different experiences, as well as my other kids' experiences. But being real and vulnerable is that connection I talked about earlier with what we do with our kids, you know, in our classes to find commonality and all that. Listen, when you've been through the journey that we've been through, and not just my son's journey, but other journeys I've had to take in my life and other traumas I've experienced, you know, and you're able to put it out there, most people can connect to that. And it takes that edge off, like you said, it takes that judgment away. And, you know, when they see, you know, me, when they know me as a professional, they know me as a man, and I'm in tears telling my story. And sometimes some more very, very detailed, you know, very, very minute details of my story. It breaks down a lot of walls. And I think if we all were a little bit more vulnerable, you know, we would understand each other better and we'd have a lot less hate in the world. So thank you.
All said. Indeed.
Thank you, Jeremy. I just want to, because we want to do this rapid thing and we want to give people a chance. So is it Helen or Helene?
Thank you. It's Helene.
Okay, Helene is, and then Brandon right after, and I believe I saw
Paula.
Yes, so let's do it in that order, and please, because we want to make sure we get those questions in. I thank you. Go. You're on.
I have a question on fitness testing. So I work at SUNY Cortland, and we're prepping our future phys ed teachers to go out there, and yet we're teaching them FitnessGram. Like, what are we supposed to do? We cannot find any non-gender fitness tests. So how do they handle that situation as a brand new teacher stepping in, trying to be an ally to their student, yet being told to administer FitnessGram and literally say to the students, male or female? How do we do that?
If you don't mind me answering that real quickly, because I do the training for New York City teachers around that. What we do is refer them to the Cooper Institute chart that explained, you know, the gender biological gender, right? And we allow, we tell teachers, let the students decide where they want to be as far as that is concerned. You provide them with the information based on the chart. You are not to make or give your opinion on anything. I believe you belong here, or I believe you belong there. That's not your place. You allow students to make that choice. That's what we do as far as teaching, to provide workshop for teachers in New York City. So I just want to share that with you. Refer them to the scientific chart and say, this is what you do, and you allow students to have that freedom to do that. That's it. And that way you protect yourself should you are asked by administrators or what have you.
That's great. Thank you.
That's a great question, Helene.
Great question.
Put that in my assessment class today. So that's a very good question, and that's great advice from Dr. Ramsey. But I still think we need obviously more answers and directions down the road.
Totally agree. Yes.
Don't be afraid if you have to change, if the student has to change, because if they're on hormone replacement, the body is going to change, muscle mass will change, and so they may start off, let's say it's a male to female student. They may start off male and then eventually move into female as a result. So it's not locked in place.
As long as they get more fit.
Yes, indeed. growth. In some way, growth. Exactly.
Yeah. Brandon, go ahead, Brandon.
Hey, thank you. So I teach K to 8 phys ed and middle school health, and I'm about to start teaching puberty 1.0. And I have a few trans students in my class, and I want to make sure that I'm teaching to all my students. So I wanted to see if you had any recommendations or resources for me to make sure that all of my students can, one, feel included, and two, have information that's relevant to them.
Well, when you say you have trans students and you're worried about the instruction, what instruction would you be worried about? I mean, I'm assuming when you say they're trans students, they have transitioned to who they are, and that's who they are. So I just need to understand a little bit better the question.
So more of how, so if I have, say, a student transitioning male to female, or female to male, is there, and many of them are still 12, 13, so they might still have not gone through puberty. Is there anything specifically that I could be teaching, right? So we're going to teach male puberty, we're going to teach female puberty, but is there like resources on what maybe a trans person may be going through during puberty, just to better educate my students?
Well, the interesting thing is they're going to go through the, and again, I'm not the expert here, I'm just going to try to figure this out as I go. If they're going through their biological puberty, it's going to happen regardless, unless they've suppressed their puberty. What their body does is what their body does. If they've suppressed it and they're not going through puberty, that's the only other change that wouldn't be happening. But I think at that age in particular, there are kids that are way ahead on the scale. They're at 1.5 puberty, and some are at 0.2 puberty. So some of them aren't going through it, some have already been through it. So I'm not sure if I have a better answer than that, but for a trans child, the only time their puberty stops, their biological puberty stops, is when it's done medically. So I don't, I wish I had a better answer. I think, you know, more importantly is just, I'm glad that you're aware that you have transgender students in there. Obviously you just affirm their pronouns, their names, however they feel comfortable speaking to them. I think that's really the more important thing at that age, if they've come out and they're transitioning. But it's a great question. I just don't think there's a specific answer that would be helpful for that child. Maybe just the conversation that you're having is that, you know, this is biological puberty as opposed to boy and girl puberty. Maybe that's an angle that you would do it. Shauna, you might be able to help a little bit on this as well, right?
I would agree that you approach it from a biological puberty. And you know, for a trans child, be male to female or female to male, it's important to know, I think, both. The reason I say that is I know several trans men who, because of finances, could not afford their testosterone and became pregnant. I know one who has just had second child, a gay couple. It's hard to talk about, he is pregnant, but you get through that. For a trans child, I think it's important to know both, and talking about it as biological puberty. And personally, I think it's important for everyone to know both sides of puberty. It shouldn't just be a dark secret. Why? Let's teach everything. More information means better educated students, which means potentially less abuse down the road, because women, be they cisgender, transgender, no longer is viewed as this strange thing with things that happen to their body. Teach it all. Be open about it all. I mean, we're human. I mean, talk about a penis, you talk about a vagina. You don't make up words for it. You're open about it.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandon. Okay, Paula, you've been waiting in the wings. Go for it.
Okay, Paula Scraber. I teach at St. Bonaventure University. One of the courses I teach is women in sports, but I'm from the state of Connecticut, and I was following this summer the case that a school district and a parents group were suing the state association for allowing transgender athletes. It was a track meet, and they said that they were in violation of Title IX regulations to allow transgender athletes in the girls' track meet that were breaking all the records. So I was talking with our compliance officer, and it's really interesting because the NCAA is very open, from what I can gather, to accepting transgender athletes. But it seems that it's the parents groups and some of these smaller school districts that are fighting. And I know there was a parent who's a legislator who recently, I don't know if it was in Arkansas or Missouri, who spoke out on, they were trying to have legislation to block transgender athletes competing in the high school. So I didn't know what you folks have in terms of how it's a they say it's a violation of Title IX, but here you want the opportunity for these athletes to excel like everybody else.
Well, I can tell you that, as Shauna said, there are a large majority of states that have laws and practices that are not trans child inclusive. That's just the fact. I could tell you, like I said earlier, in New York, New York State Public High School Athletic Association developed a transgender policy which allows transgender athletes to participate. And thankfully, that's what we're doing in New York, in my opinion. My personal opinion, again, I'm going to be real. I'm not going to sit here and whatever, is that I, you know, I struggle a little bit with it, because I try to look at everybody's side of the story and how they feel. I don't want anybody to be hurt by anything we do. But I also think that there is enough smart minds in the world to figure out a way to get it done without excluding anybody, whether it's, again, any protected right should have the opportunity, and quite frankly, I don't care if you give out 3 first place medals. It really doesn't matter to me. Opportunity is opportunity. And if an athlete is good at something, there will be a college that would, take them. I know part of the Connecticut lawsuit was that, you're taking away scholarship opportunities from my child because she didn't win the state championship in Connecticut. I think that's a little bit of baloney because you run a certain time and that's what in track that's you're given the scholarships. If you get one of those very few scholarships for track, you're given it based on your time, not because he came in second. So again, that's just my personal opinion. Everybody's all over the place about these, their feelings on this, and it becomes emotional. I try to not be emotional about it. I try to be understanding of viewpoints and listen to people. But ultimately, there's always a way we could figure something out. We do it in every walk of life. We find accommodations. We find, different options and avenues to get things done. The flip side to this, and this is the argument that I would say on my personal level, is somebody, leaving this earth by their choice because we didn't include them in something or we treat them differently. And that's not just in this community, it's in a lot of different communities. So I try to make things very simple in my mind. And by saying that, look at the big picture, keep people safe, let people feel comfortable in their own skin, regardless of whatever their identities are, in whatever walk of life. And if we live that way, we can figure it out with enough smart minds in this world, much smarter than I am.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm going to chime in here because I need to, because this is emotional. As I said earlier, kids are being used as a political pawn. The whole idea of this, we can disagree, does pineapple belong on a pizza or not?
Does not
agree with that.
Does.
But as soon as you start denying the existence of any group, that stops being a disagreement that we can agree upon. It becomes bigotry. And these laws are nothing but bigotry. And if you have a trans girl who's on estrogen, she has the same physical limitations as a cisgender girl also on estrogen. Whether you take it orally or whether it's done by your body is immaterial. The whole purpose of these laws is to deny our existence. I take this very personally. And if you look at the data, teenagers who are not accepted, 42% of teenagers who are not accepted attempt suicide. You can find this through the 2007 National Transgender Discrimination Survey, as well as the 2012 U.S. Transgender Discrimination Survey. Those numbers are standard. And these numbers continue on into adulthood. All these laws are about denying the existence of people. This is why we were excluded from the U.S. Census. We were going to be there until the last administration struck it out. So now we don't know how many there are. I'm very emotional about this. I'm very determined on this one. For me, it's not, let's find a middle ground. For me, it's, it comes down to these laws being a means of discrimination. And Title IX in this case does not apply. Or if it applies, it goes against these laws because they're denying our existence.
Can I just add also to that, the interesting part about it, and when you talk about this topic, is there is no outrage, there is no, fighting about a male transgender athlete.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that make sense? Just because they don't win? because they're not winning, you know, coming in first place. You know, they're coming in, you know, 10th place, and so it's not an issue. It's the same argument. Why is it discriminating against a trans female but not a trans male?
Yes.
Yeah.
Good point.
And can I just bring up one other, do I have time or no?
Sure.
One of the other things, again, just kind of wraps into a lot of the conversation we had, but again, it's one of the points I use when I have spoken is the word asexual, somebody who's born with both body parts. It used to be the word hermaphrodite. Okay. This is something that helps me explain this topic to people who are ignorant. So, you know, children are literally stillborn, and I know this because I have a friend who's a nurse, and they're stillborn with both body parts. And there are actually more children born this way than there are redheads in the world. That's a fact, okay? And to this day, still, not always, but to this day, still, doctors ask a mother or father, what do you want it to be? And they remove one body part and the child lives with that other body part. Now, I want to think about this logically. Shauna, jump in after I'm done.
I'm going to correct you real quick. Asexual is orientation.
I'm sorry.
The term you're after is intersex.
Sorry. You're right. Sorry. Intersex. Thank you. Intersex. So anyway, to this day, parents are asked, you know, what do you want the child to be? And the parent has to decide, and that correction is made on the spot. Sometimes parents choose not to do anything right away. So
sometimes doctors just do it on their own.
Correct. So here's the point I'm trying to make. And again, this is more to explain a transgender experience to somebody who is ignorant, or somebody who is just ignorant. And I don't mean that in a negative way, meaning I don't know anything about it. Sometimes people think ignorant is a negative connotation. But the point is, if a child was born with both parts and a doctor or a parent chose and removed one of the parts, how do they know they made the right choice? So they removed the male biological part, but maybe internally they were male at birth. And I think that has helped so many people understand what we talked about before about the binary and the continuum, because it's logic, it's science. That is fact, it happens. It happens more often than there are redheads in the world. So that's just a great example, in my opinion. I know that a lot of people have really been floored by that when we use that example. And again, for somebody who's not transgender and doesn't understand it, and they don't want that in their world, if they're willing to listen to that conversation, and I've had many people do that, it's been pretty profound. And Shauna, jump in if how you feel about that.
And the best thing to do, regardless, is let the intersex child grow up. Let them decide when they are an adult.
Right.
I've met several intersex people who were given a vagina when they were actually male. And they went through horrific trauma. It is being trans with even more trauma. Or it was hidden from them. I've also met intersex people who were male, who had a penis, but then needed a pap smear, and they didn't discover this till later on in life. They were never told, it was all hidden. And medical insurance does not cover this. So they are very much left out in the void. There are intersex kids. And if I recall, something like 2.4%, something like that, which is why we in the trans community say we are at least 1%. That means there are approximately 3.3 million of us here in the United States. Just aching for a chance to live our lives. That's it. We just want to live our lives.
Indeed.
Indeed. Right. And you know, again, when and I've come across this a lot, and obviously in the cisgender world, it happens, is that, you know, people think it's a choice, and it's not. It is who they are, just like any other feeling that we have about who we are internally. That's who it is. So, Sean, I really appreciate your openness and honesty and vulnerability as well. You're a champion, and thank you.
And thank you for sharing your experiences as a parent of a trans child and being accepting and loving.
Thank you to both. I would say our champions today are both Jeremy and Shauna. Thank you. It's a wonderful presentation. Jeremy used the word profound, and I think that really captures it. Profound indeed. So with that,
Shauna and I will take the show on the road, just so you know. I think we're a good team.
Indeed. In the chat, we have our CTLE form, so make sure you take a look at that for those that need their CTLE credit. On behalf of New York State AFERD, our EDI section, and all members, we thank Jeremy and Shauna for joining us this evening and sharing your vast knowledge and wisdom. Again, I can't thank you enough. Very, very captivating. Please visit us on NewYorkStateAFERD.org, social media handles at New York State AFERD, or call us at 315-823-1015 for more info. Please mark your calendars for our return to the Turning Stone in November. Fingers crossed for our state conference, just when you thought it was safe to swim. And then additionally, this session tonight will be posted on our New York State AFERD website, and also as the fourth episode of our podcast channel. Dr. Ramsey and I are excited to relaunch the podcast channel as an educational series, and stay tuned for upcoming episodes. So that's everything we have for tonight. Anything, Dr. Treadwell, you'd like to add?
I just wanted to thank Shauna and Jeremy again for agreeing to participate tonight. And if you think this is a valuable experience, we're considering extending the conversation into next month. And so we'll have some new panelists and new perspectives, so that we can continue the conversation and keep moving forward.